Scripture reading this morning will be from Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 13. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven.
Well, good morning. At this hour, for the last couple of months, we've been studying out of the Beatitudes, and I was reluctant to let that go, even though we had finished the Beatitudes proper. Last time, some of you had expressed as well kind of a reluctance to give up on that study, so I will continue. And in fact, as Jesus spoke the Beatitudes to them, he did not finish and discontinue his speech. He continued to speak to them for quite some time, apparently, including the few verses that Travis just read for us, which will be the focus of our study this morning. And you may have noticed as we studied through the Beatitude that there was a slight change in the form of the address as Jesus got to the last of those Beatitudes. He began in speaking to them and said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness' sake. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the pure at heart. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are you when you are persecuted for my sake." And he goes even more in that direction when he says to them, "You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world." As we've been thinking about these Beatitudes, I've encouraged you to try and picture the scene as Jesus has gone up on the side of that mountain. I've been there in that area where that sermon took place, whether at the exact spot or not, but sort of a gently sloping upward hill there at the base of the mountain, and Jesus up higher than the people, and they spread out below him. And there, as he addresses the people, they sit there and try and get as close to him as they possibly can, and on the fringes of the crowd or the religious leaders, the scribes, the Pharisees, the haughty hypocrites who look down on these very people to whom Jesus is speaking. And you can imagine the way in which they respond, looking at one another or grimacing as Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, and blessed are those who are meek, and blessed are those who hunger and thirst." And at some point, it seems, I imagine it this way, as he is finishing, they are kind of roused by all of this and Jesus' attention to these people, these lowly people that they really don't think very much of and don't want to mingle with. And they begin to go away. And at that point, Jesus said, "Blessed are you when men persecute you for my sake." And of course, Jesus knows what is coming, not only for him, but for some of these very ones who will become his disciples. And then as those scribes and Pharisees have gone, he says to them, you know, surely they have noticed that these lofty religious leaders have abandoned them. He says to them, "You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world." And it's an amazing thing that he says that and uses those powerful images about these people, these whom the Pharisees and the scribes would have thought were the lowly of society. And yet, these very people, the ones who become his disciples, do become the salt of the earth and the light of the world. It is through these people and men and women very like them that the gospel is preached throughout the world within their lifetime. They change the whole direction of human history. Jesus, of course, is the force, but it is channeled through them. They are the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And what does he mean by using those kind of sweeping images for these people? And not only for them, but I suggest, as we have about the Beatitudes, for you and for me as well. You are the salt of the earth, and you are the light of the world. Salt, as you think about it, is something we sort of take for granted in our day and age, though you'd be in dire straits without it. Some of you have been forced to find that out, restricted to salt-free diets, perhaps, and you struggle to find some substitute for that. There are no real good substitutes for salt. But straight from the ground, the salt is kind of just a dirty, granular-looking stuff. And even in those days, there were not particularly good refineries to clean it up. But the best salt of the day was highly valued. It was precious to them because it made such a difference in the quality of the food that they ate, as you well know when you use that salt shaker. I mean, we taste it out of the bowl, out of the pot, the soup, and we say, needs a little more salt. It would be bland indeed without that salt. And it is precious in other ways, too, that we don't think about so very much. Salt is a great antiseptic, and it has healing properties. And they full well knew that in Jesus' day. But that salt, no matter how precious it was capable of having the qualities of salt washed out and the impurities alone being left. So it had none of that power to flavor food and to make it better or to be antiseptic or to heal. And then it was thrown out because it was of no value at all. In fact, it became dangerous if you threw salt out when it was in that condition. You throw the salt out into the fields, and enough salt will cause the fields to be infertile. That's why in vengeance Abimelech, when he destroyed Shechem in Judges chapter 9, destroyed the city, tore it down, and sowed the fields with salt so that no one would ever be able to live and farm there again. And the salt becomes dangerous and destructive in that way. When the salt lost its really good qualities and there was just mostly impurities left, they would throw it in the streets because they didn't want to throw it in the fields, because they threw it in the fields, it would make the fields infertile. So they threw it in the streets. They threw it in the streets because it wouldn't do any damage to the field, but it would be good in the streets because it would keep the grass from growing in the streets. Some of you have sidewalks going up to your house, or you have driveways, and there in the cracks are growing up the grass and the weeds, and they do much damage. Throw it in the walkway, keep them smooth, walk it underfoot. That's what the salt was good for when it wasn't good for flavoring the food. And the salt, to be good for flavoring the food, has to be different than the food. For you to be the salt of the earth, you have to be different than the world in which you are to mix and to improve and to make it better. They valued that kind of quality as we value it today. And maybe they understood it even better than we do today. Pretty powerful image that Job uses about the valuelessness, the tastelessness of his life when he says in Job 6 and verse 6, "Can flavorless food be eaten without salt? Is there any taste in the white of an egg? Life is bland without God. The world is bland without the light of God and the salt of God in it." And that's what the role was to be of these disciples. The role is for you and me today to be that kind of condiment, that kind of improvement, that kind of flavoring to the world. The salt was important to those people, and they recognized its importance, so much so that the Bible, like in Numbers 18 and verse 19, talks about the covenant of salt. The covenant of salt in Numbers 18 and verse 19. Every one of the grain offerings that they offered was to be offered with salt to the Lord. And because of that, he called it a covenant of salt. They offered their bullocks, they offered the very best of their bullocks, they offered the very best of their sheep and their lambs. that was valuable, and they sacrificed it to God. And the salt was valuable, and they sacrificed that to God. And they were to put salt on all the grain offerings when they brought it to the Lord, is Leviticus 2 and verse 13. Every one of the grain offerings is to be salted with salt when you offer it to the Lord. It's important that you offer that which is best. The salt was powerful and a demonstration of the bond between God and man, a covenant of salt. And in fact, it's a bond between people too. In the Near East, one of the things that they do to bind a friendship together is they eat together. And when they eat together, they focus on the salt that they eat together. They will say to someone with whom they've shared hospitality, "We have eaten salt together. You are my brother because we have eaten salt together." Salt bound them together because of its important qualities. And the salt, the Bible recognizes in the Old Testament, is valuable because it is has healing properties to it. It's valuable because it is antiseptic. You remember that in 2 Kings chapter 2, we talked about that passage before, where Elisha, one of the first miracles that he did was to heal the waters that had become poisonous in that city near Jericho. And how did he do that? He poured a bowl of salt in it. Now, of course, the salt is not actually what kills it, kills the impurities or the bacteria or whatever's problem with the water. It is symbolic, however, that it is salt that he uses, because they recognize that the salt cleansed impurities. A passage like Ezekiel chapter 16 and verse 4 refers to practices that are pretty bizarre and strange to us. We just don't think in these terms today. We have other more advanced medical kinds of interventions. But Ezekiel 16 and verse 4, the prophet there says, "As for your nativity, on the day that you were born, your navel cord was not cut, nor were you washed in water to cleanse you. You were not rubbed with salt, nor wrapped in swaddling clothes." He's talking about the unnaturalness of their birth, because he contrasted with what naturally normally was done. When the baby was born, they cut the cord, they tied that off, they washed off the afterbirth, they scrubbed the boy down, the baby down with the salt, and they wrapped him in swaddling cloth. Why did they put the salt on him? We sing that. Why in the world would they do that? They did it because the salt has antiseptic properties. It has healing properties. That was an important practice. You think that's weird? I will tell you this. That was so important to them and so difficult to acquire in the Bedouin community that until within recent times, in the time of living historians, that the desert Arabs, when they had no salt, they would bathe the newborn in the salty camel's urine as a substitute for that. We're like, oh no. They were that desperate for salt. It was that important to them. It is important. And Jesus, when he says to them, "You are the salt of the earth," brings to their mind all of these kind of images of how important salt is and what a difference it could make. Greece was known in that period of time as the salt of the nations, because the Greek culture, the Greek philosophy, the Greek love for art changed all the other cultures that it came in contact with. The Romans who conquered them became really, in some ways, the colony of the Greeks, because they adapted that kind of culture from the Greeks. Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth," and he expects by that that they will understand that they are to make that kind of significant difference. They are to be that valuable in terms of changing the nature of the world in which they live, of purifying the world in which they live, as salt does in day-to-day lives. And Christians are supposed to do that even today. Christians are supposed to show the world what living for Christ can do. Christians are supposed to go about doing good, as Jesus himself went about doing good. Christians are supposed to be the means by which people ask, what's the reason for the hope that is in you? And the gospel is preached to them. Christians are the means of spreading the truth, the carriers of the salvation of Jesus Christ. You are the salt of the earth, he says. But salt, if it's lost its savor, what is it good for? You are called Christians, but you're not really Christians. You say you're my disciples, but you're not really my disciples. Then of what use are you? Because it's certainly possible for a Christian, a disciple of Christ, to mix with the world until they become so conformed to the world that they can't make any difference in the world anymore. They become like the world. Romans chapter 12, verse 2, passage we mentioned in our Bible study out here this morning, one that we think of quite frequently and ought to, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And we may add to that, based on what we're reading here in Matthew chapter 5, and that you may transform the world as well. But you sure can't transform the world. You sure can't make a difference in the world if you're like the world. We're not to be that way. 1 Peter 2 and verse 9. It's another one of these distasteful passages. It's not quite as distasteful as the other one that you've just forgotten about, but now you think about it again. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9 says that you are a peculiar people. And we don't like that so very much, so we translate it in various ways in the modern translations. A special people, a people for his own possession. But it really does mean, does it not? If we are a special people, if we are a people for his own possession, that we, if we are the salt of the earth, that we are a peculiar people, that we're different from the people of the world, made so by the life of Jesus that is in us, and that we ought, by living that kind of life, to make a difference in the world around about us. Too much like the world, you can't make the world much better than it is. Are we salt in our little part of the world? Do we make a difference where we are? Individually and as a congregation, does this congregation of God's people serve as salt in the community and make a difference? Pretty powerful image that Jesus uses. But he's not through, just in case you didn't get the point. He has another one, maybe even a more powerful point, when he says, you are the light of the world. Light and dark are images that are used throughout the Scripture. In fact, the Bible begins, really, with the image of light and darkness. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the earth. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. We know that feeling a little bit every day, or at least every night. When it is dark, we go into the house late in the evening, especially on these winter days when it gets dark early or it's overcast, and you go in and you left early and you didn't leave any lights on and it is dark, and we flip the switch and there is light and things are different. The world's so much better with light. It is a scary place without the dark. And, you know, one of the things we chide children about, don't be scared of the dark. Don't be scared. But we are scared of the dark. And we ought to be scared of the dark. Because who knows what's in the dark? Christians are the light of the world. And light is the opposite of darkness. Light and darkness are metaphors for good and evil and metaphors for life and death. In 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 5, the Apostle Paul uses that same image from 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 5 when he says, you're the sons of the light and the sons of the day. We're not of the night or of the darkness. We are of the day. We are of the light. We are the light of the world. And that means several things, of course. Darkness is about ignorance and stumbling. As Jesus said in John 11 and verse 10, one who walks in the night, he stumbles because the light's not in him. But the light is in us because we're the disciples of Jesus Christ. The light is in us and we don't stumble, and we know. We know what the world is like, and we know what God is like, and we know what heaven is like, and we know what's right, and we know what is wrong, because we have the light. And because we are the light of the world, we shed that light abroad, and we make that difference among the people that we come into contact with. Now, the action of the salt and the action of the light tend to the same result, but they have a different kind of a method by which they act. Salt acts by coming in contact with. Light sheds abroad and acts even from a distance. Salt acts internally. We are the salt of the earth when we are part of a business, when we are part of a community. The light sheds abroad even when we just pass by, when we're standing apart from that. When people can see it, it makes a difference. And if anything, light is maybe even more necessary than salt. Without salt, we have a bland diet. Without salt, we might have to resort to other kinds of things in other situations. But without light, if there was no light, if the sun was to go down tonight and not come up tomorrow, and if the sun were to be dimmed and there'd be no reflected light from the moon, if there was no light, nobody wants to live in a world in which there is no light. It would be impossible for us to live without light. Without light, there would be no vegetation. Without vegetation, there would be no food. Without light, there is no life. The benefits of light we discover over and over again. The new study they published just recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, exposure to light reduces blood pressure. Well, that's not even really surprising, I guess. Light is good. Darkness is bad. That's what Jesus said. I am the light of the world. John uses that metaphor from the very beginning in John 1 and verse 4. In him was the life, and the life was the light of men. Of course, unfortunately, not everybody wants to be in the light. Extend the metaphor. When you turn the light on, when you go in house at night in Florida, let's just say the shack or the cabin, you turn the light on, and all those little things go scuttering into the dark. They don't like the light. The cockroaches don't like the light. They want to live in the dark. They don't want the light to be turned on. And there are unfortunately people who don't like the light. They like ignorance, and they don't want the light to be shed upon them. John talks about that in John chapter 1, when he talks about there were those people who hated the light because they were of the darkness and they wanted the darkness to cover up their sins. They didn't want the light to expose them for what they were. But Christians who've chosen to be disciples of Jesus, they love the light. Even though it does expose our imperfections, we love the light because now we can correct our imperfections. Yeah, who likes to see that? You go to one of those houses where they have the special big lights and the bathroom mirror and the magnifying mirror and it comes on real bright and you're like, oh no, I didn't need to see that. But we can't correct it if we don't see it. And the light of Jesus shines on us and exposes all of our sins for the ugliness that they are, but only then can they be corrected. And there are those who hate it for that, and those who love the light for that. But the truth of the matter is, even as we are reflected lights of Jesus, because it is not that there is any light in us at all, other than the light that is there because we're disciples of Jesus, because we know Jesus. Christians reflect the light from Christ into the world. If Jesus is the sun and shines his light on the world, then we are the moon that reflects that light back. Paler and yet only possible because of Jesus Christ, and in many ways the same light that comes from him and from us and into the world. But we can cancel that out too, in the same way that mixing with the world creates so many impurities in the salt that it's no longer useful for salt and loses its saltiness. It's good for nothing but to be cast underfoot. So too, it's possible, though kind of ridiculous, that light can be made of no effect. And the example Jesus uses of that, nobody lights a candle and puts it under a basket. And it's really kind of a humorous example because nobody's that ridiculous. Nobody would do that. Why would you light the light and then cover it up? If you didn't want the light, don't light it in the first place. Don't have a light. Don't reason to light the light and cover it up. Now, some people, you know, they light the light and they put it in the corner over there and then it's dark over here and it's not to the best advantage. That could happen. But the idea of lighting the lamp, putting it under a bushel basket, that doesn't make any sense at all. That's irrational. Just so to hide the light of Jesus that is in us as disciples is irrational, serves no purpose. And no one genuinely with the light of Christ in him wants to hide that. Because no true Christian is ashamed of the light that is in him because he is a disciple of Jesus Christ. Apostle Paul in Romans 1 and verse 16 says, we're not ashamed of the gospel. Not ashamed of the gospel because it's the power of God to salvation. We're not ashamed of the fact that Jesus went about doing good. We're not ashamed of the fact that we're pure and not of the tawdry kind of behavior, the immorality of the world. Nobody adapts genuinely the life of Christ in all of its purity and then is ashamed of that and tries to hide it and pretend, you know, that they're just as sophisticated, translate, sinful as the people of the world. That makes no sense. There's a dire urgency for us to exercise the kind of influence that we can exercise in the world as the salt, as the light, as disciples of Christ, and not to be concerned about that. Jeremiah had one of the most difficult posts that God assigned to any prophet, I suppose. Well, maybe Ezekiel about the same time has an even more difficult post there in Babylon. But Jeremiah, we call him the weeping prophet for a reason. In Jeremiah chapter 20, we get some of both sides of this idea of what a difficult post he is, and yet what a privilege it is to be able to preach and to shed light into the world. Jeremiah 20 and verse 7, Jeremiah says, O Lord, you induced me and I was persuaded. You're stronger than I, and it prevailed. I am in derision daily. Everyone mocks me, for when I spoke, I cried out. I shouted violence and plunder. That's he's telling them what's going to come, because the word of the Lord was made to me a reproach and a derision daily. And then I said, I will not mention him, nor speak any more in his name. Have that sense sometimes? You try to talk to people about Jesus. You try to talk to them about the authority of the Scriptures. You try to talk to them about church. And they rebuff you and they rebuff you. And sometimes it turns out poorly, it seems. And you say, I'm not going to say anything anymore. I'm not going to make that mistake again and try and talk to people about that again. That's what Jeremiah says. And then he says this, which I think is the experience that you will find about the light that is in you. Jeremiah says, but his word was in my heart like a burning fire, shut up in my bones, and I was weary of holding it back. I could not. No matter the derision, no matter the mockery, there's no way he couldn't speak about Jesus Christ. It was that important to him. It was the light that just came out of his eyes and out of his mouth and out of every pore of his being because he'd been so transformed by that. And Peter and John had the same experience in Acts chapter 4 when they had been preaching about Jesus and they beat them and they said, don't preach anymore in this man's name. And they said, is it right in the sight of God to obey God or to obey man? We cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard. There's no way to hold it up. Their love of the light was so great that it shone out of them. It shone out of them in the words that they said, and it shone out of them in the life that they lived. They made a difference in the world because they were salt and they were light. We need to be careful that we don't hide that light. Why would we do it? I don't know, but you know, it's possible that people take a job where they're careful or have to be careful about not speaking about Jesus, or they have a family reunion, they can't talk to some of the people there about it. They can't, but how is that possible? If you're a disciple of Jesus, everybody knows it. You know it. It's a part of everything that you are and everything that you do. Ultimately, somebody's going to say to you, why? Why do you act that way? Why do you not do that? How is it that you're different? What's the reason for this hope that is in you? Because that's what a Christian is. And it's going to make a difference. And Jesus says you ought not even try to hide it. Let your light shine before men. And there will be some who will rebuke you. There will be some who will rebuff you. There will be some who will ridicule you. But ultimately, it is to the glory of God. And it isn't that we do our good deeds so that they may be seen by men and we get a reward for that. That's not the point at all. In fact, Jesus goes ahead in Matthew chapter 6 and in verse 1 to say, take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. He says to them, when you fast, don't be like the hypocrites with a sad countenance and disfigured faces so that it may appear that you're fasting. Don't do your good deeds in order to be seen and get glory for yourself. But it should always be that people know who you are. And they know who made the difference in who you are. No action of the Christian who is the salt and the light is possibly going to detract from God's glory. Because we always give the glory to Him. Our influence is critical. Our influence is important. Our influence is to be guarded carefully, as Ezekiel 7 and verse 1 says. A good name is better than precious ointment. We need to let our light shine. We need to make a difference in the world. We need to be salt that adds to and purifies the community of which we are part. And we need to live in such a way that people are always like, there's something different about that person. Why? I need to know. And maybe they reject the message. Maybe they accept it. But at least the light has shone into the world. And who else is there? The hypocrites and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they walked away. And Jesus said to those people that were left, those people who thought they probably were not worthy, those people who thought others had looked down on them all their lives, those people who thought there was no way they could have any kind of an influence, He said, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. And that sermon still resonates today for you and for me. Thanks be to God that we know Jesus Christ and that through Him we can make a difference in our part of the world. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, then you need to come to Jesus, confess that He is the Christ. Repent of your sins, be baptized for the remission of them. Be converted and transformed so that you too can be salt and light in your part of the world. If you need to respond to the invitation of Jesus, we encourage you to do so as we stand and sing this song.